Hello. This is Faye Emerson. I'd like to tell you a story about a man whom we'll just call Charlie. His story begins this way.
Well, I was born March 14th, 1890. My dad was a manufacturer of cigars. From the time I was 6 years old, I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be an actor, and that was all there was to it. And after reaching the age of 12 years, my dad insisted me being a cigar maker. I didn't want to run away from home and started singing. On the road, I educated myself, got into with the Monarch Comedy Four, one of the leading quartets of the day. I went from that into vaudeville, tabloids, burlesque, musical comedy, being considered the principal comedian.
For many years thereafter, Charlie was always traveling, always on the go. I'm sure that many of you listening have at some time or the other crossed his path. Today I'm telling you his story because, well, this is one of a special series of programs called Crossroads, and you'll see presently why we're calling it Crossroads. But now, let's go on with Charlie's story. Things went well with him for a time, and then in 1917, something happened.
September 1917, at the Gaiety Theatre in Montreal, Canada, I walked onto the stage after throwing a snowball at one of the boys in the company across the street. I run into the stage door, went up to the dressing room, put on my makeup, curtain went up, went on to do my show in the middle of the first number, everything blacked out on me. I said to the stage manager, I says, "Come on, get those lights up, will you?" He says, "What lights?" I says, "It's as dark as can be. What happened to the lights? A fuse blow?" He says, "No, the lights are on, Charlie." I said, "That's it. This is it. Something's wrong." So they took me up to my dressing room and called in my boss. He come up to the dressing room. In the meantime, we had to have the understudy go in there and take my place. He says to me, "What's the matter, champ?" I says, "I don't know. I just can't see." And he says, "Don't worry, champ." He says, "I'm going home tomorrow. I'll take you home." I said, "All right."
For the next few months, Charlie was in and out of hospitals.
I was in the Mayo Brothers Sanitarium in Rochester, Minnesota. I was at Pittsburgh College Hospital. I was at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. I was at the Brooklyn Hospital for quite a while. They couldn't do anything for me.
By this time, his savings were gone, and he was without sight. He decided to sell insurance. With his younger brother guiding him from house to house, he tried to make sales. But it didn't work out very well, and after a year, he made a decision.
So I went back to my old boss down the shore, Canarsie. I said to my boyhood chum that I had put to work down there, Mrs. Mack, I says, "I'm going back in vaudeville. You're going to be my straight man." He says, "Charlie, you're crazy." He says, "You can't do anything in show business, can I?" I says, "Will you listen to me?" He says, "Yes." I says, "Now there's the old Howard House on Atlantic Avenue and Alabama Avenue. It had a big back room, and I asked Mr. Hilgans, could I use the back room for rehearsing?" He says, "Go right ahead." Well, I used the chairs, the backs of chairs. I fixed them up as a backdrop and entrances and exit. So we worked on that for 6 months until I learned how to run off and run on in quite a straight line. And then finally I went over to New York to these agents that handled me before I lost my sight. And, of course, they were very lovely, but they didn't quite close the door, but it was, you know, what can you do? And what kind of an act are you going to do? You're great when you had your eyes, but what can you do? What are you doing? I said, "I'm going to do a straight and comedy act." "Who's going to do the comedy?" I said, "I am." "Well, we'd like to help you, Charlie, but, you know, see me so-and-so." Well, I trod the streets with Mac for about 6 months, and then finally, Freeman and Bernstein, I knew his wife. She was known as the Dresden Doll. And she says, "I'll talk to Sam." That was her husband. So he put on a Sunday concert at the Bronx Opera House in New York. So I says, "Sam, isn't there a chance?" He says, "Listen, I'm putting on 18 acts up there." He says, "What can you do? I can't take a chance with you, Charlie." He says, supposing you fall over those footlights. I says, don't worry about it. And I says, I'll tell you what I'll do, Sam. I'll go up there with Mac, meaning my partner. I says, just give me the date. Just give me the opening. That's all. I want to show what I can do. Well, through his wife and my persuasion, he said, all right. He says, no, I'm not going to pay you. I says, that's all right with me. So in the meantime, I went to all the other agents, and I says, I'm doing a Sunday concert at the Bronx Opera House. I says, will you come up and catch the act? Well, he said to themselves, well, is this guy going off his nut or something like that, you know? Well, anyhow, we got up there, and Sam come in. He's after we rehearsed, he says, I'm putting you kids on two, number two. I says, you can open the show with me, Sam. I don't care. He says, boy, you've got a lot of confidence in yourself. I says, yes. I says, was I all right when I could see? He says, that's a different thing. You can't now. Let's not fool with ourselves. I says, all right, put me on number two. In the meantime, all the other agents I went up to speak to, well, they were out of curiosity. They came up to see. When we stopped, that show so cold that we got about 35 cards from other agents, and that night we were on 14th on the bill. And from then on, we never had any more trouble.
For the next two decades, Charlie continued to earn his living as a vaudeville comedian, always on the go from one town to the next, never worrying about tomorrow, always moving. As for his blindness...
Well, during all this time, I never allowed billing that I was blind, see? I never allowed it in my publicity or in my advance billing. And I never allowed any of the reporters or anybody else to write me up as a handicapped person.
The audiences who laughed at Charlie's act all along the old vaudeville circuits never suspected. Charlie's victory was really complete. But then came a new trouble, talking pictures. As the talkie spread, vaudeville declined. During the early 1930s, it almost disappeared.
Well, and things got pretty hard, pretty tough, through talking pictures. That my partner and I, we couldn't get the money we were accustomed to getting, you know. He's now a territory salesman for a beverage concern. So we split, and then I started to work alone. I worked all the nightclubs in New York, the big and the small and everything in Brooklyn, for a good many years.
But that, too, couldn't last, this time because of television. In many small cafes, television took the place of live entertainment. And many other places closed because more people were staying home. And Charlie's engagements got scarcer and scarcer.
But anyhow, then it got to be three nights a week, and then two nights a week, and then one night a week with television. There were no business. And then I'd take a club date and an affair, like, you know, until everything died out. Then it got to be very, very tough financially.
Finally, Charlie reached the age of 65. Destitute. He had no savings. And he knew, finally, that his working days were over. Well, Charlie'd never thought very much about the future. Each day had always brought problems enough of its own. But now that there was no more work, Charlie remembered something. He remembered that years before, in Brooklyn, a theater manager had explained to him about some new salary deduction. Charlie hadn't quite understood it at the time, but he had assumed it was all right. It happened this way.
I was working at the Brooklyn Labor Lyceum, and our manager come to me and he says, Charlie, I want to read something to you. I said, all right. I said, what is? He says, oh, well, he says, I've got something new here with the things here. I don't know. They got us now. We're going to be bookkeepers and so on. I don't know. I read it anyhow. I said, all right. Well, that was the first time I knew of Social Security.
Charlie was booked there for 4 weeks, but stayed many months. And all that time, Social Security deductions were made. Now, during later jobs, Charlie was never quite sure whether deductions were made or not. We almost forgot the conversation about Social Security. But when he reached 65 and saw only poverty ahead, well, he thought he'd better find out about it. So he asked his Social Security office. Well, the news was good. Charlie learned that for 19 years and small deductions from his wages, he'd been helping to provide for his old age. Now, at 65, he was entitled to monthly payments. It wasn't charity. It was a kind of insurance. It was something that he and his various employers had been paying for together. And now it seemed almost too good to be true.
Oh, the most important thing in the world. I look for that third of the month like a ravenous dog looks for his supper. Believe me, I count those days, and I want to say this. To me, it's been wonderful.
Charlie still does some work. Over the telephone from his home, he sells magazine subscriptions on commission, helps pass the time, and supplements his Social Security. And so Charlie lives comfortably, at home, and remembers his days as a performer. He remembers how, in theaters across the land, his singing voice could make the rafters shake. One of his favorite numbers in those days was a song that went like this.
There's no when love is new, now is forever when I'm with you. So kiss me and hold me tight. There's no tomorrow. There's just tonight.
There's no tomorrow, said the song. But there was a tomorrow. And when Charlie stood at that important crossroads of his life, the end of his working days, he found that he was ready. Today, 9 out of 10 working Americans are building Social Security protection. Protection for themselves in their old age and, in case of death, for their families. Are you sure of your rights and what you should do about them? Well, here is some advice from the Commissioner of Social Security, Mr. Charles I. Shotland.
Charlie's story shows how a person who has many different employers during his working lifetime builds up Social Security retirement benefits. Each employer reports the amount of his earnings. And over the years, all those reports for many different cities and states and for many different employers are brought together. How are all of these records brought together? By a Social Security account number. Your Social Security account number is the key to your Social Security payments. Be sure to show your Social Security card to your employer if you change jobs. If you're self-employed, make certain that you copy that number from your card onto the Social Security reports you make each year when you file your income tax return. And know your Social Security rights, and tell your family about your old age and survivor's insurance protection, too. If anything should happen to you, they should know how to claim any survivor's benefits due them. For more information about what Social Security is and what it means to you, ask your nearest Social Security office for your free copy of the booklet, Your Social Security.
Thank you, Mr. Shotland. This is Fay Emerson inviting you to listen again to Crossroads, stories brought to you with the permission of the people who lived them. This program was produced for the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare by the Center for Mass Communication at Columbia University. Charlie's story was edited by Eric Barno.